This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. For years now, Port Townsend and Jefferson County have recognized a housing crisis that has threatened not only its most vulnerable population, but even those who have secure, well-paid jobs. This week on the Compass, we talk with co-housing pioneer Charles Durrett, an architect who for more than three decades has made community the central focus of his practice, including not only in the design of local retirement community Quimper Village, but now in creating village-style housing for the homeless. So now, let's go inside the Compass. For our audience members who may not be really familiar with the term co-housing, you have been one of the top proponents of co-housing in the United States, and that has been an integral part of your work for decades now. So tell me what co-housing is and how the concept of community figures in your design process in general.
Yeah, I've been involved with it for 35 years now, and I actually coined the word co-housing. I got a call from the Ministry of Housing in Denmark, and they said, Chuck, we're gonna translate the word, hopefully escape, tomorrow, and so we need a word, come up with a word. So I stayed up all night, and I came up with 35 words, and I landed on co-housing. That's the long story.
Tell me the Danish word again.
Bofællesskaber. Bofællesskaber.
And what does that literally translate to?
That literally translates to living together communities.
Okay, that's quite descriptive. Yeah.
So co-housing, you know, the Danes would say that it's not really new, but it's fundamental to who we are as a species. You know, we grew up for thousands and thousands of years in villages and clans and tribes. And then all of a sudden came the 20th century, and a lot of forces atomized us to the fullest extent possible, estranged us to the fullest extent possible. There was a book came out in 1919. It's called The Single Family House. The foreword was written by Herbert Hoover. And Herbert Hoover in that book said, no man who ever owns his own house will ever become a communist because he's too busy painting the fence and mowing the lawn. And there were lots of other reasons that the forces that be wanted us to live separate, because then you had to have a lawnmower per house, you had to have a washer and dryer per house, you had to have a refrigerator per house, you had to have everything per house. So it really fueled consumerism like nothing else. And then if you spread it out into Chicagoland, where the movement started for single family houses, a lot of people credit Levittown in Long Island, and certainly that had a role, but that was much later. That was after World War II. Before World War II, there was a concerted effort to get the managers in Chicago far away from the workers, because if they lived in the same tenement buildings or anywhere around each other in downtown Chicago, then they empathized with each other, and the capitalists didn't want the managers empathizing with the workers, so they got them on a long highway to Chicagoland, and actually had mass transit out to Chicagoland for many years until the 1950s. And then the automobile industry, you know, just convinced everybody that the roads was a better way to go, and commuting on highways and such. But anyway, so co-housing is just a conscious effort to create a high-functioning neighborhood, something that happened much more readily in the U.S. once upon a time. And there's six components to it. One is that the future residents play an integral role in the creation, the design, the development of that neighborhood. Because it turns out you can have planners with PhDs, and between the planners and the bankers and the business people and the builders, they really don't have a very good clue on how to make a high-functioning neighborhood. But people, real people do. They know that if we do this, I'll feel comfortable going to next door and borrowing a cup of sugar. If we do that, I will, if you put a garage door in my face, I won't feel comfortable. And I hear it over and over again. I've designed 55 co-housing now, and people constantly ask me, hey, Chuck, why don't, you know, you've designed so many, why don't you just design it? And we'll look, well, you know, we'll review it or something. But A, they won't know what to review unless we have a very thorough process. And B, they always design it better. I say, no, I want to design it with you, just like in Port Townsend. Quimper Village was very hands-on on the design of that project. And it's not just about getting the design right. It's about getting the buy-in, you know, one line item at a time. Their cars are 300 to 500 feet from their front doors. And that's a senior co-housing. When that project was designed, the average age was 72 and a half when we designed that project.
Wow.
And these are seniors who very consciously decided that their relationship with their neighbor was much more important than their relationship with their automobile.
Well, and I guess so, in a way too, if like the residents are involved in the design of the place, I mean, one of the central values, it's obvious to me, is the building of community. So that community has already been building for a matter of a year or two or whatever by the time they're moving in.
No, it's fully ensconced by the time they move in. But the architect's primary job is to maintain it over the years. It's easy to have it when you move in. There's lots of examples of that. And then it subsides within a year or two. So, you know, making it feel like a village is the beginning and the end of the long-term relationships, basically, but not the short-term. The short-term is the exercise of creating a neighborhood together, for sure.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So you say you've designed some 55 projects. I mean, have you maintained some kind of relationship throughout the history of all of those projects?
For the most part, yes. I mean, I come to Port Townsend every year or so, fewer times the last year. But I was just in Bellingham, Washington, spent 4 or 5 days walking through their maintenance with them. And I come up with an excuse one way or the other to hang out with them from time to time. I really appreciate it. You know, I really appreciate the folks and I really appreciate the sense of just voyeuring, sitting on somebody's front porch with a beer in my hand and watching the relationships, you know, grow and expand. And it's beautiful. I love it. Mm-hmm.
You reached out to KPTZ and contacted us because you've just finished a project, the Valley View Senior Housing Project in Napa County in American Canyon. And this is a solution. I mean, the title of this book is A Solution to Homelessness in Your Town. I understand you have done other affordable housing projects in Oakland and San Francisco, but those were large buildings, whereas this is a village. And I was interested to see that in here someplace you have a photograph of like a traditional village in Europe, which pleased me because I lived in France for a year and I traveled around and was just completely charmed by these medieval villages that you can still visit, which many of them are impossible for access by car, and they have little winding alleyways that go actually like through tunnels that are underneath rooms. And they're just wonderful little hives of humanity, the likes of which we haven't seen built in hundreds of years now, but are the kind of thing that humans seem to like to build for themselves when left to their own devices. And you're really kind of resurrecting that feel with the building of villages like this. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the genesis of the Valley View project. And then we'll go from there.
If you try to design something medieval, which is my favorite planning methods, these days, the bureaucrats will shoot you down. It's nowhere in their zoning codes. Their zoning codes were created. The very first zoning code in the U.S. was created in Berkeley, California in 1916, and it was blatantly racist. It says in the zoning code, this is to keep the black people away from the black and the Asiatics away from white people.
Wow.
And so the multifamily is over here, and the single-family houses is over there. And then the 1930s came along, and we started redlining, and that really put a nail in the coffin, in my opinion, into bringing people together, and anything small, fine-grained, basically. Everything became very coarse-grained, single-family houses into the horizon. Anyway, yeah, Valley View started with, I wrote a book once called Revitalizing Our Small Towns, and it's about 77 towns in southern France in Luberon. And the head of community development in American Canyon got a copy of that book, and then he immediately bought 10 copies and gave 5 copies to the Planning Commission and 5 copies to the 5 city councilors. And so I'm a big believer in that books can actually make a shift, and they certainly did in that case. There were 28 applications before ours to build a homeless project in American Canyon, and they all were a single building solution. And it was certainly the logical conclusion, but it's not what the town wanted. So anyway, then I did a village-like setting, and that was exactly what they wanted. And they told me profusely that this is not only what we want, but it's what the whole town wants. And there was zero acrimony. We didn't have one person come to the mic and say, I don't want a homeless project in our town. And not to mention, this was smack dab in the middle of single-family houses. And we still didn't have anybody come against it. There's old agrarian on one side and single family houses on the other side. And the agrarian it's a sheep farm and will probably be single family houses in the future. You know, so often the biggest difficulty about getting a new homeless project built is the neighbors. And this was very palpable to the neighbors and to the, we got 5-0 vote. In 2 public hearings, which is unheard of.
Yeah, no, that's very unusual. I've been involved with a homeless shelter here in Port Townsend for 15 years now, and it's in the basement of the American Legion Hall. And I mean, it's had the approval and cooperation of the city government throughout, but that has not been without its moments of controversy, for sure. And it's a problem. I mean, you know, we have in Port Townsend, as much of America now, we have an ongoing housing crisis, officially declared so both by the city and the county governments. And I mean, it's not only, I mean, among the unhoused, I should say, are not just the usual suspects, but many two-income families, people who have perfectly good jobs. I was just talking to a woman yesterday whose daughter and son-in-law, between them, like make $200,000 a year, and they can't find a place to live in Port Townsend. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's
so
hard to believe.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, there's a serious lack of houses in the inventory. I mean, there's just nothing for sale.
Another reason we're doing these custom neighborhoods. Because we're actually able to do them affordably. I mean, we take the 30 households that come to the table, and if some of them don't have money, we figure out a way to make them a house. And I mean, if you look at the project we did in Port Townsend, 28 units, those houses started out at about $300,000. That's unheard of in Port Townsend for a brand new house. But you can't get them that now. They're going to be $500,000 in just a couple of years because there's no limited equity. But they're very valuable. So, you know, when people want affordable housing, my take on it always is get involved. People are not going to make affordable housing for you. They will make it with you. Lots of people will come to the table and make it with you. But if you want affordable housing, you better get organized. And if you don't get organized, then you're just subject to the marketplace. And the marketplace is going to have its way with you.
Right. Well, so let's back and talk about the Valley View model a little bit, because I have lots of questions about financing, for one thing, and ownership, and what sort of, you know, like rules people have to live by there, and how you list some criteria, like including being veterans and having been unhoused or being at risk of being homeless. as being like the criteria, but how were the specific people who benefited from this project picked out?
You know, it was an application process, and unfortunately, it's only 70 houses. We had 480 applications the first day.
Wow.
So it wasn't difficult. I mean, they literally turned off the applications after the first day and then went through the 480 and said, okay, I think these people have been homeless long enough. And for the veterans in particular, we got a little money from the VA. So they gave some preference to veterans. But I'll never forget when a man stood up at the podium at the grand opening, which there was 150 people. And he said, you know that freeway you guys drove in on to get to our little town today? And, you know, it's a little bit of a pause. And then as the guy was, you know, composing himself, he said, I slept under that freeway for 6 years and now I have a home and I'm going to die in that home and I'm not going to die under that freeway. You know, the average American homeless person dies at 49 years old. And that makes homelessness in this country a death sentence. And I will say we had 16 funders in that project, 16 organizations that came to the table. Home Depot kicked in 50,000, for example. And I've never seen a groundbreaking where every funder came, and I've never seen a grand opening where every funder came. And I'll just tell you, these funders were giddy. They were always giddy. It was always so buoyant. And it had to do with these people. Everybody knows that homelessness is a crisis in this country. It's 1 million to 3 million people, depending on who's counting. And now these 16 funders felt strongly that now I can be part of the solution. And normal nonprofit projects have about 7 funders. This was 16 because we needed, you know, we were on a 56-foot vertical grade difference on the site. There's very few perfect sites around anymore. So we had to mitigate that. That cost us about $1 million right there. So we had to keep getting more funders. And, you know, the funding came through because so many people realized that homelessness is a travesty in our society. We've had 4 people die in my county in California, in Nevada County, recently. One was 42, one was 48, and 2 were 49 years old. Wow. These are homeless people.
And they died of exposure or they died of...
Yeah. Well, you know, it's always compounded by alcohol and more. Right. But all 4 of those were alcohol. And every homeless person I meet around here, it's cold, it snows, and they always say, you know, comes midnight, I've just got to get to sleep. And so I just take a couple shots of whiskey, and then that, you know, that builds up on itself. And, you know, there's a movement afoot that's called Housing First. We're not going to deal with all the mental addiction issues unless we get people under roof. And I appreciate that. But I'm a bigger believer in community first. You know, make it function like a community. Whatever homeless project you're building, make it function as a community, because then these people are set up to start to take care of each other. And they actually can do a very good job. Not all of the issues, not, you know, post-traumatic tension and not, you know, addiction. But, you know, we have 3 counselors in the common building at Valley View, and they do a really good job of helping these people get back on their feet. No doubt. But really, where the support comes from is each other. And they help each other get their feet back on the ground there. And counseling each other, they're really counseling themselves. They're basically verbalizing what they already know. And they're continuously setting each other up for success. And I am blown away by how much sweat equity the homeless people do once they live there. All the things that I did a project in Oregon where there was no sewer, no water, and they had to truck in the water and truck out the sewage, and they put in, you know, sewer and water themselves by a little organization, you know, and I really believe in that, you know, that gave them purpose too and brought them closer to a serious community. There's so much that can be done. There's so much low-hanging fruit. All it really comes down to is getting organized.
So let's describe this place a little bit for our audience. I mean, I have the benefit of looking at your little book here with all of the photographs and so on, but and I could describe it, but I'm sure you would do a better job.
Well, let me start off by saying I believe it's in the Fort Townsend Library, and I'm pretty sure that you can get it in the bookstore in Fort Townsend. So I want to say that so that, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk at Fort Townsend on your radio show is because I feel like there's a movement afoot to get something done here. And I understand that they're making some tiny houses, but in my view, it doesn't really pay to put one tiny house here and two tiny houses there and three over yonder.
Right. Well, actually, talk about getting organized. There's a grassroots organization in town here called the Housing Solutions Network that oversaw the building of, well, was part of building those. There was this amazing guy named Peter, and the tiny house community is called Peter's Place. And the Methodist Church down in Hadlock actually has located all of those tiny houses on their property, which takes advantage of Washington state law that affords a certain amount of religious freedom to religious organizations. So they were able to do that without the usual sort of zoning and planning. And the tiny houses are able to, the residents are able to make use of the church kitchen and bathroom facilities. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The bathroom, they put Santa cans, like, you know, out. That is a good but sort of stopgap solution. They're only allowed to be there for a year, apparently, under this law. So then they have to move somewhere else. New tiny houses are being built at this point. But still, in terms of the long-term solution, it's out there. The latest stimulus bill has provided some like $6.4 million that can be used towards housing. And there is a search underway for a property where more permanent facilities can be built. So I think some of the principles that you've outlined in this book are being closely considered, of having sort of satellite bedroom facilities and a common house and so on, which is really what Valley View is. And so just getting back to the description. So there's what, some 58 cottages, like one single bedroom cottages. And then, why don't you sort of inventory what
walk through it? Sure. I always get the number, but it's 54, I think. Single floor, one bedroom cottages that are 450 square foot each. And then there's one building of 16 units that are flats, eight downstairs and eight upstairs. And that building there is theoretically where folks are going to move to later in life, you know, and they can get some assistance all in one building, physical and mental assistance all in one place. And in my view, you know, there are so many homeless shelters that it is ephemeral. You have to come and go. And, you know, we did a project a few years ago where there were all single mothers with one or two children. And the moms all had to be in school. This was a nonprofit, and they had to be in school. And I finally talked the nonprofit into not making them leave once they get out of school, because in my view, the magic is all in the community. To the extent that these people help and, you know, grow to appreciate each other, the extent that they know each other, care about each other, and support each other, that is the fact of the past. You know, the future is now kind of, you know, how we survive as a species is people knowing and caring about each other and then supporting each other. So the point is, we talked the nonprofit into not kicking out these moms once they got out of school, because now they have a support network. They actually make dinner for each other in the course of living there. You know, they share the cooking responsibilities, just like co-housing. Where I live, a 34-unit co-housing in California, we have dinner on the table six nights a week for those who want to come and participate. And there's nothing more timeless in building community than breaking bread together. Mm-hmm. And it plays a role. And over a long term, I've lived here going on 16 years now, and there's still a lot of people that I are just learning to appreciate, and just learning to appreciate enough that I would do things for them and they will do things for me. So you can just, there's a lot of math involved with building a viable society. And there's a lot of prejudices that get in the way of that math. Like, you know, we can't just give these people something for more than a year. It doesn't make sense. You know, our job as a species is to build a viable society, a community. And every species, their job, number one job, is survival. But I'm going to argue in the case of Homo sapiens sapiens, that we don't survive unless we learn to cooperate. And I don't mean cooperate one iota more than you want to cooperate. So what I love about co-housing is that people find that there's a lot more to be gained by cooperation than lost. You know, for example, where I live, 34 houses, we have one lawnmower. And we have hundreds of other things that we share together because it just makes sense. We don't need 34 of them, basically. You know, so it serves me as an individual to have this cooperation be kind of the medium. We do all cooperation by virtue of consensus. So, you know, we spend 15 minutes talking about getting a new lawnmower. And by the way, you can be sure it is a state-of-the-art electric lawnmower, because a couple people will come to the table that say, hey, you know, let me shop for that thing. Let me get that figured out. And, you know, we recharge it with solar panels, and it makes nothing but sense, especially in the context of things like global warming. Hardly anything is more polluting than a two-cycle engine. So you get lawnmowers and chainsaws and weed eaters all, you know, consuming gas. You can be sure you're as deleterious as possible to the environment. But if you get all that stuff state of the art, you know, you can be more benign. And but make one 20, 30, 30, 40 unit project after another, it is a number of people, like a typical village, that you can organize together. You can manage it together. You can make decisions together. You know, you're not delegating all the time. There's no power structure per se. It's not political. It's just human beings trying to figure out how to get by. And it seems to be, you know, the Danes would say never do anything with more than 50 adults because that's harder to manage. And I've never seen any society. I lived in Denmark for 2 years, and I'm not saying there aren't others. I know there are others, but I've never seen any Western society which really tried to resolve the social math more and better than they do. They think about things that I've never even heard of in the U.S. when it comes to doing the social math. So, and 50 adults is their ideal number for people managing themselves.
With co-housing architect Charles Durrett, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Saturdays at noon and repeats on Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.